This Voice of the Arts podcast is made possible thanks to the Carnegie Museum of Art.
You are listening to the Voice of the Arts, WQED-FM. I'm Jim Cunningham. Here is the voice of Robert Aubrey Davis, who is joining Baltimore Concert for a presentation of Chatham Baroque, Renaissance and Baroque in Pittsburgh, having to do with Mary Queen of Scots. We're looking forward to that on Saturday night. And of course, I have to ask you a little bit about your long stint as the host and creator of Millennium of Music, your work on Sirius XM and WETA, you've done TV, you've done radio. What an amazing contribution to the art scene in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Robert Aubrey Davis, we're looking forward to seeing you in Pittsburgh again.
Well, Jim, it's great to be back because I adore Pittsburgh, and there's so many reasons. You know, not forget culturally, there's other reasons to go to Pittsburgh, but also culturally, there's so many reasons to be up there. And of course, all the great work you've done over the, I think it's what, 75 years with the Pittsburgh Symphony, you've been hosting that series and all those great things you've done. So it's quite a deal up there, you know.
Well, we do have fun. There's no question about that. It's a great town for the arts. And Chatham Baroque has been a connection for QED since their very beginning. We're always thrilled to tell people about what they're up to. Now they've taken on the role of keeping Renaissance and Baroque presentations vital in Pittsburgh. So Mary Queen of Scots, now, the formal name of the show, it has the word weed in it.
In Angel's Weeds, yes. It's one of the poems, the sort of a tragic after Mary is beheaded, a beautiful poem by Robert Sutherland. It sort of looks at her afterwards, but of course we kind of trace the whole history from her childhood all the way up to this terrible ending that she suffered. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've worked with Baltimore Concert before. How did that connection come about?
Well, I actually, I began doing early music in the 70s, even before I came to WETA, and I had a lively interest in it. And before they were the Baltimore Consort, and in antiquity, the Renaissance Ensemble of Baltimore, they very kindly invited me to come up to some meetings, and I joined their board in those very early days. We did a series of performances, including in the late 70s and 80s, we did a wonderful series. You know how you see those Renaissance paintings and you'll see these people kind of gathered around looking at a musical manuscript, or there's an angel playing a lute looking at a manuscript or whatever. They found the music in the paintings, and we did a series dedicated to the music in the actual art. We had a slideshow with narration I would do. And we took that to colleges and universities, you know, basically all over the East. It was an amazing experience. So, but I've been working with them forever and done liner notes. And then, of course, I worked extensively with Ron McFarlane, and we did that long-term series, which was dedicated to music and poetry about the lute, called Blame Not My Lute, that we later recorded, award-winning recording that we did with Dorian Sonoluminous. And so it just goes back forever, and I kind of kept my hand in with them and many other early music groups, but they're a blast. They're great, they're wonderful to work with, and a lot of fun too, yeah.
They are returning because they have been so well-received in the past. Tell me about this program with Mary Queen of Scots. Why should people come?
Well, I think it's so interesting to me how her currency and the fascination with her is periodic. You know, we go from, oh yeah, it's more important to honor Elizabeth, or is it more important to think about what happened to poor Mary and those others that had to be dealt with before, you know, Elizabeth could really safely reign. And, you know, there was, during the 60s and 70s, I think the rebirth of the British folk rock scene. You had, you know, Sandy Denny and writing beautiful things with Fairport Convention, Fotheringay, of course. And then there's the Dougie McLean's wonderful song. There's been a series of pieces of music that kind of relate to her that I think brought a whole generation back in interest. And when you go to Scotland, you go to Edinburgh, you kind of do the Mary Queen of Scots tour. But quite poignantly, one of my early music buddies, John Potter's at the Orlando Consort and stuff, we went to Peterborough, and, you know, there she was interred when she was allowed to be officially in a cathedral for two or three days before they, you know, dumped her. But you can actually go to what's left of the Fotheringay, and you can see the, you know, the ruins of this, because after her death, it was all torn down. And it's just very, you sort of feel something very intense and poignant. And the tale, the story, I think, has an impact. And so the way people dealt with it, I mean, one of the things that the fellas did with the consort is found, even though I'm pretty conversed with this stuff in the poetry, I had not really figured out some of the subtleties. And so we do some readings that kind of get into that as well. And it's really, you know, it's a charming, intense, and very sad story with very beautiful music attached. And of course, they perform it wonderfully, as they do, you know.
You love this music. This is your thing. The music of 1,000 years before Johann Sebastian Bach is the general realm that you inhabit. But what do you especially love that's on the stands of the players of the Baltimore concert in this program?
Well, you know, they do both the bright side and there's the happy tale. And I kind of like the, I kind of brought my little cheat sheet here because this is actually what we're doing for this one. But, you know, we kind of do the bright side, some of the early pieces that were inspired. Ronsard, the famous French poet, was in the court and knew Mary. Of course, the lingua franca in the court there was French. And so everybody spoke French. We have that kind of thing to introduce things. And then we kind of get into the idea of what dancing was about and why it's so important. And then we have Mary, who was a poet in her own right, writing poetry. And you sort of come to her happier times writing a poem to Ronsard, and then you have the very difficult time when she is writing her last poem before she's put to death the next day. And then you have the poem after it happened. And quite remarkably, the people who were alive at the time, William Byrd, most famously, were celebrating the 400th anniversary of his death this year. He wrote something for her. Many people did. And it's kind of poignant to reflect on all of that and feel what that's all about and why and how it happens. And oh, my goodness, it's quite a story. So we kind of, we have a happy half and then a very sad half, kind of like that, yeah.
Now, you mentioned in passing the texts that you will be reading, the words that you will be delivering. How did you go about selecting what you would read and then how much to read? As you know, music lovers are tough when it comes to programs that involve narrators.
You know, it's odd. They are, but I think we have forgotten that there were many generations where people would travel from place to place and recite poetry. And there were entire careers, Vachel Lindsay in America and many others, were built on the live recitation of poetry. And I do think, while there is a certain flinching about that, when at the end of it all, people sort of think, oh, yes, that's right. Poetry, read well and well read, are very important things to, it's a music unto itself. And I do think that's very much there. Now, some of these are rather more, I would say, amusing to reflect upon. You know, we do a little bit of the Dancing Master from Trois Noirs Beaux, one of his wacky reflections on dance. And then some John Knox, because, yes, these fiery Scottish sermons very much were concerned with Mary and her attempts to take over a throne, and that was a big deal as well. So it's a pretty broad range, but I think by the end of it, people, when you come to that very beautiful last poem, Alive a Queen, Now Dead I Am a Saint, written after her death, is just a very intense thing to think about, you know. And the history is amazing too.
You'll be in a beautiful setting. The church is wonderful. Have you had a chance to visit Calvary yet?
You know, I get around Pittsburgh every time I'm up there, and it's always a joy and a delight. And I think one of the most fun things is that you go to some cities and people think that, oh, yeah, we're so great. You know, you just know we're great. But you go to Pittsburgh, everybody's just flat out enthusiastic. They want you there. They want you to share, you know, hey, there's this, but have you seen that? There's this part, but have you been to this one? You know, and I kind of adore that. I think that's one of the great, it's one of the great things about the, I don't know, Pittsburghers, the Pittsburghois. I'm not sure what there's the, probably the right phrase there for the Pittsburgh people, you know.
Okay, Robert Aubrey Davis, how did the early music fascination, enthusiasm, love start for you? Was it listening to the radio? Did I see somewhere it was Josquin des Prez that someone turned you on to and it all kind of flowed from there?
Well, weirdly, on the most important thing to understand, as I always say about people who get involved with this, this is all arguments for reincarnation, because any otherwise, why bother? But because you're going to be doing the Beatles soon, as I understand, about the informational conversation about this new release. And well, that's, you know, that's back to the time of Josquin anymore, basically. But there was a Baroque program on our local classical station, WGMS, hosted by, this is before public radio, of course, hosted by my predecessor and namesake, Bob Davis, who was an incredible gentleman. And I listened to that on Saturday mornings on my little radio next to the, so I kind of poked around. And at those times, there were great concerts that came downtown. I used to go to catch the bus as a kid. I mean, literally, a tween, 10, 11, 12, I go down to the Library of Congress, or I go down and see a concert at the Constitution Hall and see the Prague Madrigal Singers, or see first Alfred Deller at the Library of Congress. Then I went back and saw Alfred Deller many times, and that was the key. It was Alfred Deller who got me really deeply involved in the world of early music. And I asked him one time if I was going to try to track one composer, who would that composer be? And his son thought he would have said Purcell, because he's a great Purcell person. But he said, no, Josquin. Follow Josquin, and everything else will come from there. And that was a good tip. So I picked up some of the early recordings of Josquin and listened to those and carried it with me, and that kind of blossomed out. And when I first, when public radio began, I desperately tried to break in, and I couldn't, because, you know, it's an exclusive club, as you so well know, Jim. Very few people can make it, but I wound up going to Jacksonville, Florida, getting my first job and creating what was then Musica Antiqua. And then when I came back home to Washington and finally got into, first I was at GMS for some years and then went to WETA, and Martin Goldsmith allowed me to do the first program Easter of 1979, which is all chant. And I used the Musica Antiqua rubric, but of course there was a group named that, and I was threatened with a lawsuit. So rapidly, in fact, overnight, had to come up with a new name, and Millennium of Music, that's, it came up pow overnight to avoid any other issues. That's exactly how that is legally.
And Millennium of Music is now heard on Sirius XM, the Symphony Hall channel as well.
It is. It's heard on about 100 stations in Symphony Hall. In the past, I was on WQED, but I know you dropped me because you don't like me anymore. But if you like me, I'd love to be back, you know. So
we'll
all these years later.
On that. It wasn't my decision, Robert.
It never is. I know how it goes. I know. But it's still cooking and still hopping. I'm still doing new material. And yeah, it's crazy but true, you know. Yeah.
Now, how do you bring people into the tent? Why is it regarded as something even brainier than chamber music? You know, the people that build models of ships and bottles, listening to Machaut and Palestrina and Josquin des Prez. How do you bring people in? What's the path that you've found?
I think the oddity and peculiarity is it is a, such a titanic range. On the one hand, you have people who, for example, miss Gregorian chant. And then you have young people for whom Gregorian chant gets to be this haunting and beautiful, meditative, mysterious thing that means something else. And then on the other hand, you know, the early Baroque is fascinating and fun, and people are experimenting and people are doing crazy things. There are these amazing stories from these people and the composers, their lifetimes, the way it is. We don't really understand unless we spend time with it. The Middle Ages, we misjudge it. So much of what we think we know about it isn't true. And then when you go to a Renaissance festival, which of course is not the Renaissance, it's basically from the very early Dark Ages to really pretty much the Restoration, but it all kind of gets lumped in as the Renaissance. People see people reconstructing music. A lot of early music people get gigs at Renaissance festivals, and that's a titanic, industry in its own right. So that's all floating around as well. And, after I began, there were other shows that there were some shows that have been doing this, one in Boston, a couple of others. But there have been some shows that followed my tracks and came along and started doing it. And, people find it. People find it. And that's fine. That's the idea, Yeah.
But you are much more than an enthusiast for very, very old music. You are a champion of the art scene in Washington, D.C. And are you still appearing on WETA television with your Around Town spots?
Yes, we're doing Around Town Best Bets and kind of choose. In fact, I'm looking at the topics for this upcoming taping and too soon, a couple of weeks. So I got to get back from Pittsburgh and get on TV. Yeah. But it's very pleasant because, we get to choose from a huge range of things. And we do, dance and art exhibits and film and a lot of theater and that kind of stuff. We have a great theatrical scene here. So it's nice to be able to do that. I'm still doing, pre-concert seminars. I mean, I began with the Folger Consort in 1979 doing their pre-concert seminars and, just done a lot of that kind of stuff. And I do other performances and narrations and I host. We had a wonderful at the Cathedral, Washington National Cathedral, just a couple of weeks ago, concert of the Mexican Baroque era. Music from the cathedral in Mexico City, and it's a fantastic scholar and a great Mexican professor from George Washington, and I hosted that. That was fabulous. So we do that kind of stuff as well, and I just kind of keep my hand in all of that kind of thing because I'm entirely too young and or immature to retire. I'm not sure which one of those two things, but yeah.
Just had the Kronos Quartet in town last night, and David Harrington, their violinist, is 74, and he says, "I don't know anything that would be more interesting than this, so I'm going to keep going as long as I can." He refers to the R word. Don't retire there, Robert.
The other thing about the Kronos, look how much early music they've done. And I mean literally everything from Hildegard von Bingen into some pretty obscure and interesting Baroque things and personal and the like, because they have fun, they like doing, and that's fascinating music. Why not? It's fascinating music. So every time I come to jazz people who work with early music and the like, and there's a lot of that, that's always interesting to me to see how people pick that up and get the feeling for using like jazz improvisation, which is very much part of the Renaissance, late Renaissance kind of thing, and even sometimes in the Middle Ages as well. Yeah.
Way back in the mists of time, I had a chance to participate in WQED's art show. It was called Studio 13. It was a half an hour in format. It was comprehensive in covering all the arts things happening around town. I always think we should get back to it. I think it's a niche that public broadcasting fills that nobody else is really filling. And your show has changed somewhat in format. It's shorter, is it not? Didn't you do longer?
Yes. It used to be a half hour discussion program for decades. And yes, 2 Emmy Awards, thank you for playing along, but over the course of time, it got shorter and shorter because the decision was made that what we needed was things that were interstitials. So instead of, because public TV shows are kind of short, and if you have a half hour block and you have to fill 2 or 3, 4 minutes, stick us in, why not? That was kind of the thinking there anyway. So we get stuck in. But I'm petite, I'm small, I can be shoehorned in wherever you need me to be, and there I am,
It's You're perfect. The host of the Around Town segments, but you have two guys who are your co-hosts, right?
Well, I'm actually the host of those, and then what we do is we have different experts. We have film people, one whole thing. We have art people. That's another whole thing. We had a wonderful dance person for quite some time. A lot of theater people, because they kind of float. And then we have that, you know, and then each one of them has a specialty. By the way, each one of them has their own particular interests and specialties and curiosities and that sort of stuff. I don't do, for example, contemporary art. I'm not good at that. But I think before 1910, I got you. That's kind of how I feel, you know.
And do you get to big events at the Kennedy Center? Do you get to the National Symphony?
I do. I mostly, if I go out, I do theater because it's something that comes and goes, you know what I'm saying there. And for the Ken Sen, you know, it sort of depends if there's a big spectacular program. I've done work with others weirdly and peculiarly. We have two very fine harpsichord series here in Washington that run partly out of people's homes and partly out of venues downtown, with bringing in the very best harpsichord soloists. So that range is pretty broad as well. And I've done this wacky series. There's a brass ensemble that's reconstructing music from the time of San Marco with Gabrielli, and now they're trying to expand out and what else was happening in San Marco that wasn't Gabrielli, and they're coming to me helping to design a program around that. So there's that sort of stuff as well. So there's a lot of hippie hopping around with that, you know. And I get to Baltimore. Baltimore's great. So yeah, there's a lot of things up there too. Mm-hmm.
Quick observation on the arts scene that you see from the center of it all, the nation's capital. Once again, there's an effort to take federal funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting happening right now. The NEA always seems to be a lightning rod for controversy in our government world. And yet you and I work in this world where we see the power of the arts to save lives. It always seems like it needs some federal support. The great societies of the past have had government support for the arts. What's your take on the arts scene from the nation's capital, where the arts are? How could it possibly be, Robert Aubrey Davis, that the arts are controversial? We know it saves lives, it changes your mind, your thinking, it improves your health, all these good things.
One of the most poignant events in my life, I was very close to Livingston Biddle, who was the co-founder of the NEA and served, of course, for many, many decades. And that was his number one principal, and at one of the election cycles, you know, 20 odd years ago, he was talking to, because with WETA, we do a lot of reception that involves, because I work for Sharon Rockefeller, so Senator Jay Rockefeller, I was very close to. And so we do a lot of things with senators and Congress people. And at one of those events, Livingston Biddle was there, and he was trying to buttonhole one of these senators, saying how important it was to support the arts. And this guy said, "Livy, you have to understand, there's more to this world than the arts." And I thought Livingston was going to cry. And I thought that was one of the most heartbreaking things you can hear from a congressperson. Because, you know, I also work extensively with the Recording Academy, and lobbying for artists' rights has been such a key thing. And it is just very difficult to, it's funny, because you can find someone who you wouldn't expect to suddenly support the arts because it's important in their home district, like the blues in Mississippi. But it's very hard to get a sort of general sense that it's good for everybody. And that I think it's an uphill battle. You might remember, Jim, the old Drive to Survive, when public radio was going to go bye-bye. We all had to go on the air and gather money and help support public radio because it was going to die. And we did, and it didn't. But that is always something, NEA and NEH. I mean, they're both always under the gun, and it's a tiny fraction of the support per capita of other nations, other civilized countries. You know, there's so much more money per capita that goes into the arts. All those countries that are happier than we are, the Denmarks and all that stuff, always have much more support for the arts than we do on a per capita basis. But we do what we can, you know.
Some legislators at the concerts you go to, I was talking, we just hired the associate principal trombone from your Kennedy Center Orchestra, Douglas Rosenthal, and he used to see Ruth Ginsburg at a lot of operas and happenings. And of course, think of the folks in the White House. There was Truman, controversial figure for many reasons, but he did play the piano, and his daughter was a singer, famously argued with Paul Hume in the Washington Post. Those legislators that have some love of the arts in their heart, I always think they're very special. If only there were more of them. My goodness.
John Kennedy, of course, most famously with all those incredible concerts he had.
Gasols and Bernstein at the White House. Wow.
That'd be nice to have again. No, Justice Ginsburg was incomparable, and I had the darndest and amusing anecdote. You might know Jim Ginsburg, of course, who runs Sedia Records out of Chicago. Well, he used to come to WET all the time. We talk about his latest release, and one day he came, and I said, "Well, Jim, you want to come by?" And we chatted, and I said, "Why are you here anyway?" He said, "Well, my mom's gotten a job in town." I said, "Well, that's so great. What is she going to do?" "Well, she's a judge. She's going to get a job like that." And I thought, "Wait, my wife's a lawyer. I'll ask all about it. What's her name?" "Well, her name is Ruth Bader Ginsburg." But, yes, that's how, and then I got to know her, Justice Ginsburg, and I used to bring her CDs. And after her husband passed, I took a collection of CDs down to the Supreme Court and dropped them off with her. But she was just unbelievable. And it wasn't just opera. It was opera, theater, National Symphony, everything. She came to everything. It was breathtaking. And to see people like that, Justice Blackmun was like that. Some of the justices were very invested in the arts, and that's nice to have, you know.
Robert Aubrey Davis, I could keep you going all day. It's so
yes,
much-
please do. I have nothing to do in my life, and this is the most important thing, Jim. That's all there is to it. What's more important than Pittsburgh? Nothing. That's what I say.
Have a safe trip to Pittsburgh. Have a wonderful experience with the Baltimore Consort. We'll look forward to seeing you when you get to Calvary Episcopal Church, and I hope you'll be returning soon. Next time, budget a little time to visit us at 4802 Fifth Avenue. We'll look forward to hosting you there.
I will actually be sleeping in your office because I don't have a place to stay. So I don't know if they told you this yet, but I'm looking forward to that as well. If you haven't seen Jim's office, wonderfully appointed. There's a huge four-poster bed. There's a full bath. It's fabulous. So I can't wait to be there. I'm looking forward to it.
Until we meet again, Al Peter Zane. We'll
Thank
see
you, buddy.
Thank you, Robert Aubrey Davis.
Thank you, Jim.
This Voice of the Arts podcast is made possible thanks to the Carnegie Museum of Art.